My name is Mike Diedrich, and this is the Veterans for Peace, Daniel Ellsberg, Chapter 92 radio show, which is broadcast on KODX 96.9 and FM. The audio of the programs can be will be archived there, so you can see past or listen to past broadcasts. This broadcast is actually a continuation of a couple that we've done already on the Golden Rule. And you can see those broadcasts or listen to those broadcasts there. So with me today is Helen Jacquard, the project manager for the Golden Rule and its trip. And the last time we talked, I think we were in Bal Harbour, Seattle. And why don't you take us on? Well, actually, we should introduce for those people who's not familiar with the Golden Rule. Why don't you give a short synopsis of what the Golden Rule is and its mission?
Thank you. The Golden Rule is a sailboat, and it's also a national project of Veterans for Peace. This little sailboat was used in 1958 to try to interfere with nuclear weapons testing in the Pacific. And they made it as far as, so this is 1958, the U.S. had used 67 nuclear weapons in the Marshall Islands between 1946 and 1958. So the Golden Rule was sailed by four Quaker peace activists to just get in the way. And when they were in Honolulu, resupplied and headed out again, they were forced back by the Coast Guard and arrested and spent 2 months in jail in the Honolulu City Jail. Another boat took over and did make it into the Marshall Islands. That was the Phoenix of Hiroshima. So the story of these two boats has inspired people to keep working on eliminating nuclear weapons ever since. So the Golden Rule was found in pretty poor shape in Northern California, Humboldt Bay, in 2010, and restored for 5 years by Veterans for Peace, Quakers, and people that just love wooden boats, especially this one. So since 2015, we have been sailing for a nuclear-free world and a peaceful, sustainable future. So we have been all over the west coast of the United States, up into Canada, down into Mexico, all over the Hawaiian Islands, and we did a complete circuit of the eastern United States, including a visit to Cuba in 22 and 23. It took us a whole year. So this boat's been used a lot, and I'm really happy that we were able to do another successful sailing trip this year back up to the Pacific Northwest.
Great. Thank you, Helen. So when we left the last prior broadcast, the boat was sitting in a marina in Bal Harbour. And from there, you guys went where?
So we had a wonderful visit in Seattle and based out of Bal Harbour Marina. And then we went to the Lake Union Center for Wooden Boats, where we were able to take people out sailing and had a wonderful event at the University Friends meeting in Seattle, arranged by Veterans for Peace and others. So from there, we went to Tacoma, where Sean Arendt of Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility and Washington Against Nuclear Weapons arranged for a really big event. It was a big party on the beach and right in downtown Olympia. It was, I mean, right in downtown Tacoma. It was really, really wonderful. And a lot of people came, including some Marshall Islanders, which I thought was really great. And then, so after Tacoma, we went down to Olympia and we were in downtown Olympia, again, with Veterans for Peace and a lot of other peace activists there. Again, we took people sailing with us and we had a really great event at Traditions Cafe. I would mention that our Seattle activities included some work that our ambassadors did before the Golden Rule got there. So we were able to protest against Fleet Week By having Zoe Bird, one of our Golden Rule speakers, attend with Veterans for Peace when the parade of ships came through on July 30th. And we were also able to do many of the activities regarding Hiroshima and Nagasaki days while we were in Seattle area, including being at the Bangor Trident nuclear submarine base for their commemorations. And many of some of our ambassadors walked with the Buddhists, Senji and Gilberto, during their annual peace walk for that leads up to commemorating Hiroshima and Nagasaki events. So, I mean, we were there for all kinds of various things, even without the Golden Rule. And the Lake Union welcome was amazing. And Mike, I really want to thank you for showing up and helping to put on that program and making sure that the people that came to speak and to play music were with us. And without you being there to take the ball as it needed to happen, it would have been a lot more disorganized. And so you really helped keep things, you know, on track for us. I really appreciate that.
Well, thank you. And also mention that you were the we had a video presentation at the Friends Center there, right by the Sadako statue, which is a another sort of issue for VFP because the Sadako statue was vandalized, stolen, and the various people, including overseas Japanese, were getting the funds together to replace it with a similar statue or something very anyway, that was a fundraiser for VFP and also the boat and the statue. So that was a nice video presentation. It was a little glitchy, but it was
Oh, yeah. You know, and that was our first presentation of the year, trying to get multiple speakers and microphones happening was, you know, the first time we tried that configuration. So I'm not too surprised we had a little bit of glitch. I think
Yeah.
I've solved all the problems, but you know, it takes a while.
It does. And there's always something that could go wrong. So,
You know, it's wonderful to be at Ivers. I don't want to plug anything, but being right there at Ivers Salmon House on Lake Union, so close to where the University Friends meeting is, was really special. And it was nice that the crew was able to be there until our event started at the University Friends meeting. Then they had to go put the boat away in preparation for going to Tacoma, so they weren't able to get back in time. But so Tacoma, Olympia, and then from there, we went up to Blaine Harbor Marina, and Blaine is right on the border between the US and Canada at Peace Arch Park. And we had many of our Canadian friends, as well as friends from the US, especially Bellingham, come join us for a big peace potluck in the park. We had speakers and music, and it was a fantastic day, leading up to some activities we did when we were in Canada. So from Blaine, we also went to White Rock, BC, where, you know, the local population was kind of surprised to see a boat docked at their dock that was so big. But we got a lot of attention right there on the waterfront in White Rock. From just ordinary people, but they have a really good, strong peace community there too. And then we sailed up to North Vancouver, and we were docked at St. Rock Dock, they call it. It's right there on a big waterfront area, and that's where we were. Well, we had a welcome and presentation talking about all kinds of different issues like oil development in BC and, you know, climate change, as well as the threat of nuclear war. And so then we went to, there's a place where there's a, it's called the TMX pipeline terminates. They carry bitumen oil, which is really thick. thick and yucky, and it won't even flow through a pipeline unless you dilute it with some other really nasty, very volatile chemicals. And then they load them onto these giant ships. Well, these ships are so big, they can't get underneath the Second Narrows Bridge unless it's high tide, because they have too deep a draft and they'd run aground, which is just like a recipe for problems. They also just barely fit under the bridge. So, again, a recipe for problems. And we were talking to some of the public safety people. You wouldn't be able to clean up more than 10 or 15% of a major oil spill in that little bay. So we joined with the locals. We didn't play the key role because they've been protesting against this pipeline and this plan for taking this oil out from there for a long time. And it finally got implemented, and now we have to protest against the existing new infrastructure. So from Vancouver, we went down to, well, actually, that's north to Deer Harbor. We went to Friday Harbor. Friday Harbor, we were in there in 2016, as we were in most of these places that we went. The skipper that at that time was Terry Lush, and his dad, Ed Lush, was the fourth owner of the Golden Rule. And Terry got to sail on the Golden Rule in 2016, but he sailed it a lot as a youth because their family owned this boat for about 15 years. His dad sailed it through the Panama Canal, all around the Caribbean islands, and back through the Panama Canal to the West Coast. So it was really special to spend another couple of weeks on the Golden Rule with Terry. We had a discrepancy a little bit in who was going to crew when. And I ended up not only jumping on board and being crew for all of the Canada work, but something happened that was really special. My cousin, who I had been in touch with last probably 30 years ago and had just been together at a family reunion, I found out she's a sailor. And so she and a friend of hers came and helped fill in. It was great. So when me and Terry and my cousin and a friend sailed that boat from Blaine to Vancouver. And another person that sailed with us, Tim DeCaro, is with International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War. And so he's a sailor also. So we just randomly found wonderful crew members to sail with us. It was really great. I'll be putting out a report that's much more detailed about who sailed with us when, all of our events and all of that. You'll be able to find it on our website, vfpgoldenruleproject.org. And I just started working on it today because the Golden Rule is not even back in its home port yet. But right now, so we went up to the Victoria Classic Boat Show, mostly wooden boats, mostly old. And that's again, we were there in 2016, and that was really cool because we won the Best Working Boat Award. So when I went up with the rest of the crew to accept the award, it was like, okay, well, we're not a tugboat. That's one kind of working boat. And we're not a fisher boat, but we work hard for peace. And they recognized that. And we got a huge round of applause when we won that award. So that was very rewarding. The maritime industry, sailing people like that, they come from all walks of life. They're rich, they're poor, they're conservative, they're liberal, they're progressive. This is a way that we get to reach out to the general population more when we're in a wooden boat show. And boy, we had a lot of help to pass out flyers and educate people about what our project is all about. And so I really love those particular things. So Terry Lush, when we got to Friday Harbor on San Juan Island, he put on a really fantastic event for us at the San Juan Island Yacht Club. And so eventually we worked our way over, went to Bangor Trident Nuclear Submarine Base, where we did a water-based protest with we had four kayaktivists out there, and we had three or four people aboard the Golden Rule and lots of people ashore. So it's a very effective way to protest against these nuclear armed submarines, which even one of those would it has enough firepower to destroy all of human civilization and kill billions of people.
So what do you have any sort of interaction with the Coast Guard? U.S. Coast Guard?
Well, yeah, I mean, US and Canadian.
Yeah.
It's kind of funny. When we went into Canada the second time, these border patrol agents came up and started asking a bunch of questions as we were
U.S.
trying to check in to be in Canada.
Yeah.
And so it turned out they had a copy of our flyer that had all the various events we were doing in Canada, including the protest against the oil pipeline and tanker. So they just kind of wanted to know what kind of trouble we were planning. And of course, none. I mean, this is an educational mission. We don't risk arrest of the crew or seizure of the boat, especially in somebody else's country. But, and then we had like three or four other official agencies come talk to us in Canada. But when we were out doing the protest at Bangor, it's just like they make sure that we don't cross over an imaginary line between buoys, because then we might be a danger to those nuclear armed submarines, or find out too much information about this base, and who knows what we could do with that, you know. But everything was pretty friendly. The first, there were actually two Coast Guard or maybe Navy people or maybe both that we interacted with. The first ones were like pretty aggressive and made up rules that didn't exist, and just to keep us a little further out. And when we were kind of, you know, finishing our sailing around and starting to head back, and you know, and the kayaks went fairly close in, right up to the actual line. And so we did too. And so that was kind of interesting, because the second crew that had come by around by that time, they were really relaxed and stuff. And one woman, Kathy Riesbach, had a big birthday party on the shore. And so when we were just kind of playing around out in the water, one of the kayakers brought out a big piece of cake for the crew. So we got that, and before we headed out of the area, we put ourselves on speakerphone, and we all sang happy birthday to Kathy. And the little two-person crew aboard the Coast Guard boat sang with us. So, you know, when all was said and done, everything was really peaceful and happy and friendly. Our protest the next day at Indian Island Nuclear, or not nu sorry, nuclear. Not nuclear. Change that. We were at the Indian Island Munitions Depot that's right across a small bay from Port Townsend. And we just went out there just to see what was going on, take some pictures, and have ourselves taken pictures of in front of that munitions depot. And we did get a good shot from the other boat. And the USS Nimitz was what was sitting there right then. One of our people on crew said that the Nimitz has been to Israel, not sure exactly what it was doing there, what exactly it was doing at the munitions depot, but it was probably taking on new weapons. I don't know. Big aircraft carrier, not sure what it would be doing at a munitions depot, but maybe they need to take on arms for their aircraft, not sure.
Yeah.
And then the Port Townsend Wooden Boat Festival is just amazing. And I got some really cool pictures from the Golden Rule of all kinds of wonderful giant sailboats with their, many, many masts and sails on these boats. It was just amazing. So, that, and we had a really great event there at the Friends meeting. Lots of different Quaker meetings we attended, which was great. So when we were done in Port Townsend, we headed down to Portland, well, Vancouver, Washington, for their annual Peace Fair. And that was amazing. They filled up this whole park with tents that were staffed by people from all of the various progressive organizations. And so, that was truly wonderful. They had a big stage and lots of music and lots of good speeches. So I was really happy to have been there before we went across down the Willamette River to Portland, Oregon. And there, we were at the Multnomah Friends meeting. We had a really good peace party in the park, much more casual. And taking people sailing out, in the Willamette River was really great. And eventually we made our way over to Rainier, Oregon, where the Trojan nuclear power plant used to be, and had some really good events with them before finally heading out to Astoria. And now the boat is in Newport, Oregon.
So I assume that you and other fellow travelers have filmed a lot of this encounters and trips. And is there any sort of prospect of actually making that into a some sort of a documentary or a video, splicing together the? I mean, it would take quite a bit of editing to do of the trip. I think that would be a great sort of promotional sort of thing to do. We could probably even sell CDs of it.
That would be a really good idea. There's a lot of film available we could download from Facebook, and we've made a lot that is, the higher quality maybe that never went through Facebook that we could get hold of. And then you can, of course, intersperse some stills with that. So it's entirely possible that we could. It's pretty well documented on film and stills, and it's just a question of fitting that in with a winter program this year in our home port of Eureka. Humboldt Bay is the home of Eureka and Arcata and several other small towns. And they're pretty progressive there, and people there love the Golden Rule. The Humboldt Bay, there's several members of the Humboldt Bay Yacht Club that have offered to help take care of the Golden Rule this winter and get her out on the water sailing. So we're hoping to put together a program where people can come and see the boat, invite us into their space for discussions, and go sailing.
Great.
So it's the first time really that we've done a winter program at all in our home port of Humboldt Bay. So I'm looking forward to that.
Well, I know while you were up here just before you got to Seattle, you had to replace an engine or transmission.
A transmission. Yeah,
Yeah.
the transmission had been just starting to act up a little bit when we were doing the Great Loop, and it got to the point, in Humboldt Bay where it's like, oh, this isn't going to work at all. So we were able to order a new one and get the new one put in, and it's been working just great. There's
So,
a lot of work to do on a
yeah,
boat.
especially wooden ones. So, do you have to pull a thing out of the water every year or so and get it bottom painted and that sort of thing?
We do, and we did, of course, this year as well. That's exactly right. We pull it out of the water. This year, the rudder had come off in the mud of Humboldt Bay. So not only did we put it back on again while it was hauled out, but we also changed the position of the gudgeons that are on the rudder that go on to the pintles that are on the aft end of the boat, which is how it makes the hinge that makes it swing. And our boat wasn't acting right under propeller. Turned out a little bit of adjusting this time finally solved the problem, and now she runs straight if you take your hand off the tiller. So they did a great job of that. But yeah, well, we've got it out. We inspect all the through hulls and do any maintenance we need to on the sonar, and which is provides us with our depth. And then we paint the bottom and the top sides and the tow rails while it's out of the water, and then we splash it back in. So everything really looked pretty good when we took it out of the water this time. So I was pretty pleased about that. And then once it got back in the water, our skipper, Steve Bach, did a great job of putting to work the other, or well, not putting to work. That's not exactly what happened, but with the crew of five people did a great job working together to get this boat ready to sail. And they spent almost 2 weeks at it. The list of things to do was 5 pages long. They managed to accomplish the uppermost importance, 4 pages. So there's still some work to do. But, you know, that included things like getting the life raft recertified and getting zippers onto the mattresses and cushions, and you know, lots of things that needed to be done. We replaced all of the lifelines instead of cables. Now we have this special kind of rope that's stronger than steel. And the first mate, Bridge Randall, knows how to work with it. And he was able to splice that so that now we have not just really strong lifelines, but they're also easy on your hands, and they're smooth in their in the places they go through the stanchions, which are the vertical pieces that stand up. Anyway, he got that all really, really well grooved for us, so that now we've got a much better lifeline system.
Now these lifelines are
Anyway,
actually,
a lot of work.
yeah, they're at the, these lifelines is the exterior sort of, well, we wouldn't call it rope or lines that prevents you from falling overboard or tries to prevent you from falling overboard. So it's very important to have those things in good condition. Yeah. So you know, I've have some familiar with wooden boats, and I know that. Was that boat built planked with like Port Orford cedar, or was it Doug fir? Do you know?
It's called sapile. It's a kind of really hard mahogany that grows in Central America where the boat was originally
Oh,
built,
really?
which was
Okay.
Costa Rica. Yeah. Now, when the hole in the side was repaired and they had to put in some new planking material, that is Purple Heart, which is a very hard, really beautiful wood that grows in Africa.
So that's pretty exotic hull by American wooden boat standards. Yeah, it's nice, and it holds up well. It's also pretty rot resistant, as I understand it. You know, I should mention to
Right.
people that don't know that the boat is steered with a tiller system. It doesn't really you could call it the helm, but it's not really a helm as in a wheel helm. It's a tiller. So when you're going across the Pacific, for example. It's like 4 hours on, 4 hours off with your crew. And I know that Michelle mentioned it by the time she got, they got shoes, and she's a little younger person. She says she was exhausted because that's a long, with what, four or five crew? That's a
Four crew, right? So most of the time there were two people up and two people down,
well.
and a 4 hour on, 4 hour off shift is something that's pretty good to do at night, or if it's really cold out, you want to shift people around pretty frequently. But for 30 days, that's really hard on your body, and everybody was exhausted when they got in. Not to
Yeah, and that,
mention they were cold and couldn't get
yeah.
dry. I would hesitate to send this boat that far away again to Hawaii because getting back is so miserable.
And Let's see. Yeah, because it's a tiller system, you're always fighting that tiller. You got to stay on it. You can't let it go. I mean, a wheel, you can sort of tie it off and sail sometimes with it, but not a tiller. So, and there's the way
Right.
it's,
So we do tie the tiller to one side or the other
yeah.
oftentimes because it can get stormy out there and can try to get away from you. And sometimes one person without a tiller tamer would have a hard time holding on to it.
Yeah.
But I mean, in this Puget Sound trip we were just on, except for the coastal sailing, and even that, I don't think they had any trouble. When you've got a well-balanced boat, as in what sails are up and which direction you're going, it's not too bad. It's just you really depend on your captain to be a good sail master and know what sails to have up when. And how far out to shoot them?
So, how long does it take to get a new crew to get familiar with the boat?
Well, depends on their previous experience. We've had
Yeah.
experienced captains come on and they get the 2 hour what's where and if they need it, how to use it, and they're ready. We also have had beginners like I was, I've been sailing on the Golden Rule for almost 10 years. And there's a lot about sailing I still don't know, although I know most of how to operate everything on the Golden Rule. So I try to give everybody at least the 2 hours of standard training. And beyond that, there's a lot of just, we always have an experienced captain and usually have an experienced first mate aboard. And that means that one or the other will be either on the tiller or at least above board, keeping an eye on things at all times. So it's not really, nobody's ever in danger, and you always have enough experience in your crew to make sure that you can make whatever transit you're planning.
So, what is the golden rule? What sort of you imagine you have sort of replacement, like the engine is a diesel engine,
Yes, it is.
and is that how many thousands of hours does that engine have on it?
Not that many. It's got around 2,500 hours right now.
Yeah.
So, not that many. Even though this engine has been all over the place, it's probably got 20,000 miles on the boat since the new engine was put in 2018. Because we've been to Hawaii and back and all around the Great Loop and down to San Diego and back and up to Canada and back. So, and we put a lot of miles on this boat. Fortunately, some of it's full-blown sailing. But a lot of boats, they're only used 2 or 3 weekends a year. The Golden Rule, she's out there for months at a time, and sometimes a year or two at a time without hitting a, home port kind of place. And this year is really unique for us because sailing in Humboldt Bay in the wintertime may or may not be happening every week or something, but it turns out it's a lot easier than we thought. And with a boat that's completely ready to go like we are now, we're going to be doing it, home port programs like we've never done before. And I think people that helped us get this boat rebuilt for those 5 years are going to really appreciate having not just the boat at the home port, but also a lot of opportunities for people to interact with the Golden Rule ambassadors and the Golden Rule boat itself.
That's very cool. Are you planning to do anything, say, further south? You have any plans to actually take it through the canal into up the East Coast? You actually did put it on a truck and brought it out to the East Coast 2 years
We did
ago.
that. That's yeah. We took her over in 22, brought her back in 23. Well, That's interesting that you should ask, because we have now a new project manager, Michelle Kanoelehua Marcinet. Kanoelehua is her Hawaiian name. She's the niece of Captain Kiko, who was the captain going across from Hawaii back to California, and she was on that voyage. Well, she also has some relatives in Panama and would really like to see the boat go there. I don't have any particular objections, and if she wants to be the primary person to put that trip together, it might work out okay. There's advantages and disadvantages to doing it, of course. One of the advantages would be that we would be able to stop in all the Latin American countries that have signed the United Nations Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, and who are part of the first nuclear weapons-free zone, also the most powerful one. So it would be nice to remind everybody that they are part of a nuclear weapons-free zone and thank them for their good work on that on both sides of their countries, because most of them have both Atlantic and Pacific or Caribbean ports. So I would think that that would be really good. The reason we didn't go through the Panama Canal for our Great Loop voyage is because you're away from your target audience, which is to get our own government, the US government, to stop interfering in the internal affairs of other countries and to help eliminate nuclear weapons. Neither of those primary messages is as appropriate in a foreign country. So that part of the program would be very different than what we do when we're in US ports. Not that we can't do it, it's just that we'd have to put on a whole different kind of program for that part of the voyage. So I guess the answer is maybe we've done some
Maybe
thinking about it.
in Spanish, perhaps in Spanish.
Let's see,
Alternative,
en
if you don't
español.
want to go to the canal, you could take it all the way across, around the Horn, which would be.
I don't think I would put this icon of peace through that. And that's the other reason why we didn't go through the Panama Canal the first time, is because she's an old lady and she needs to be treated with a lot of respect and care. And I would really hate to see anything happen to her while she's trying to sail for peace. So there's
Through
this
the
balancing act there about how we should do things.
Roaring 40s, as it's called there in the Southern Ocean. Outside of Humboldt, are you going to go further down the coast?
I don't know. It can't happen until at least mid-May next year, because once we're in Humboldt for the winter, there's not much opportunity to leave and go out to the ocean from there. It's really dangerous place. Even crossing the bar from Humboldt Bay out to the ocean is a really dangerous thing to do. And the winter times, oftentimes you get storm after storm after storm, and there's just no way you can take the Golden Rule out of there. That said, we did it. The winter of 21-22, we did take her out of, oh no, we were in San Francisco Bay. We took her out of San Francisco Bay and sailed down to San Diego and back. But, there were times when that in itself was kind of dicey. So winter travel in the Pacific is hard to
It
do.
is
That's why
the
our
weather.
trips, around Humboldt Bay are probably not going to go out to the ocean very often.
Is the crew went from Seattle when you left Seattle to go to Canada and then and back again? You went through what, two crew changes, three crew changes, and skipper changes?
Let's see. For as far as skipper changes, Steve Buck did both our northern and southern routes along the coast, as well as into Vancouver and Portland up the Columbia and Willamette Rivers. But Captain Kiko Johnston Kitazawa took the boat all over Puget Sound. So he took over in Seattle and did Tacoma and Olympia up to Blaine. And then Terry Lush did all of the Salish Sea, the San Juan Islands, Vancouver, Victoria, and into Port Townsend, where Steve Buck is now again skipper taking us south. So we had, four different sections of different captains, but both of the coastal routes were Steve Buck. We had probably only about a dozen other crew members this year. Sometimes we have lots more than that. But I was really trying in the planning stages to keep things fairly simple, have a little bit shorter sailing season this year, and not have such a crazy schedule on different crew members. Now, most of the crew members that sailed on the Golden Rule this year have been on the Golden Rule sailing with us before. So it was even unique in that way. Not a lot of new sailors.
Sort of the reception specifically about nuclear weapons and the treaty for nonproliferation. How was that received in the various places that you docked or you showed up? I know that's part of the big mission, but how about that nuclear message? How was that received by people?
Everybody would like to see nuclear weapons gone, especially in this air arena where we're facing possible nuclear war over Ukraine. Even the Israeli potential Iran conflict could turn nuclear because Iran could turn to China or Russia or North Korea for help. It's really pretty frightening that the United States is not just arming Ukraine, well, I mean, so is Europe. They're arming Ukraine, and they're basically saying that we can cross every red line that Russia sets up. And yet, even despite the billions and billions, hundreds of billions of dollars that have gone to Ukraine to fight this war, they seem to be losing. And yet they're doubling down on asking for more and more weapons, and now they're asking to attack Russia per se. And that is the final red line that I think could potentially cause the kind of trouble that none of us want to see. And so we need to stop arming Ukraine, and we need to stop arming Israel. It's not just Gaza, it's the West Bank, it's Lebanon, and who knows? Maybe Jordan, maybe Syria. The whole Middle East is about to explode with the aggression of Israel. And I think that it's time for the US to stop playing into all of that. It's time for our policymakers to listen to the 60% of the US population that says to end the war, end the siege of Gaza and the whole Middle East by Israel, by withholding our weapons.
Well, yeah, I know that
Only the
the
United States can do
yeah,
this.
I know that the presumptive presidential candidate Kamala Harris has a little softer of view of this than Biden does. Biden is pretty much a hawk. He's shaking hands and hugging Netanyahu, but she's actually said, and people wanted her to say more about a ceasefire and a. I don't know exactly how, if she does win, how far she would go to actually stop the weapons. But I mean, all those bombs that we give them are American-made bombs, that they're 250, 500-pound bombs, and most of the stuff is all dumb weapons. It's not fancy. It's not fa fancy weapons. It's the same kind of bombs we were using in Vietnam. And we got a lot of them, so we'll
So
see.
maybe the idea is to modernize all and create new weapons factories, which puts a lot of US government money as profits to the military, weapons makers, and just opens the door to the corruption that already exists,
Yeah.
and more and more and more and more war. The US is talking about a three-front war at least, one against China, one against Russia, one against North Korea, and they have been putting everything in place for that. And yet, we seem to be running out of weapons. We seem to be running out of conventional weapons because we've sent all that we can spare to Israel and Ukraine.
Well,
So I'm
yeah.
wondering if we can actually engage in a three-front war with the rest of the world and, come out of it without the United States having been attacked itself. It's foolish.
It is. Well, they've restarted some of the weapons production lines in this country, particularly for artillery shells, which is a mainstay of the war in Ukraine in particular, not so much Gaza. But the United States is one of the largest weapons producers, if the not largest weapons producer of the in the world, and it's a major industry.
Yeah, and the US government takes our tax dollars to the tune of over half of the discretionary money, and puts it into the, military industrial complex in the form of war and militarism. If we weren't spending half of our discretionary funds on that, we could be adequately supporting our families.
Pardon me.
It's time to think about this moral document called the US budget and stop pouring money into weapons and war and start pouring money into let's make this a better world for everybody.
Yeah, child care, education, health care. It's really disgusting when you think of some of the Republicans they oppose. The child food program for kids in schools, the programs that allow mothers to have time off after giving birth. And I mean, they are certainly you think that if you looked at that on a face of it, it says that this country doesn't really care about its children.
Right, exactly. It's so sad. The child tax credit that was implemented during COVID was a very big welcome to the people, to the families. And that's been taken away. And now people are again struggling just to feed their children. What kind of society does that?
Well, especially in a society like this, I mean, which is the richest country in the world still, by far, that we don't prioritize this sort of thing. I'm a hope and optimistic that that with Harris as a new president, these issues will be actually something that's more useful to talk about because you don't have to. I mean, the Republicans are without any sort of. I mean, talk about a group of toxic, fascist people. I think they'll have another discussion. They're starting to have that already. But getting Harris, who's made a lot of noise about being, the big dog in the world. Hope she could get toned down that rhetoric and actually just put her money where her mouth is and actually put into some of these programs that's helping people. During the Vietnam War, we spent billions on that war, but the country is so rich that it had no problem at all indulging our social programs like the war on forward, that sort of thing. It went through with Johnson. We ran a war and we still did that. So I mean, it's a rich country, a
Right.
very rich country. We can afford
It
this.
certainly is. We have a lot of natural resources. We lot of have a lot of talent and a lot of brain power. And it's a shame to be using it the way that we are. And I don't know about partisan politics. I'm not voting for either one of those yo-yos, but we all have our own opinion about all of that. I think that we need to take our country back as people. We need to have more democracy. If 60% of the people think something, I think that we ought to respect that.
Yeah. Well, of course, you know, unless you're thinking of old, was it H. Brown or something like that, politics doesn't come out of the barrel of a gun. So you're stuck with activist protest and voting and nonviolent. These are the things
Well,
that we've got.
there is that. I think that we need to get more creative. People are tired of the vigil on the street corners, the weekly vigils. I think that they've become less effective. I think even big demonstrations have become less effective because the people that want to suppress the voice of the people have learned how to marginalize those voices. So I think we should get creative with plays and street theater and music and things that can get people excited. It's okay to scare people to death, but then you have to give them a way out, right? So I think we need to think a lot about our tactics as we build our movement to end war.
Well, a big first step in that is actually getting rid of our nuclear weapons, and it's VFP thanks you in particular, but also the other people who have made the Golden Rules trips and message really a success for what over 10 years now, and it will continue with getting the message of world peace and also disarmament. It's a very important message. You know, it's the only organization really that's doing this on any sort of a scale, and a visible scale, because the Golden Rule is really a visible sort of thing. It's right there in front of people's faces. So we're going to
Yes, and
probably
we
have.
should make the most out of just having this boat, and using it to get as much attention as possible. The Golden Rule is an excellent tactic for ending war and nuclear weapons. And as my partner, Jerry Condon, often says, it's really hard to get rid of nuclear weapons until you change your attitude about war and war making. You know, a lot of the reason that these weapons exist is because we've got an aggressive attitude rather than a cooperative solution-finding attitude towards other countries.
So great. Well, this is I'm Mike Diedrich with Veterans for Peace, Chapter 92 here in Daniel Ellsberg chapter. And with me is Helen Jacquard, who is the project manager for the Golden Rule, with yet another installment of the Golden Rules Odyssey. And this is broadcast on KODX 96.9 FM Seattle. You can listen to the archives there on the radio station. It's also archived on VFP92.org. So thanks again, Helen. This has been
And
great.
I will take that link and I'll put that link up on the VFP Golden Rule Project.org website as well, so that our Golden Rule supporters will see it there too.
Okay, Helen. Thanks a lot.